matters or the, to look with reference to the matter that is in court that she has to prepare documents and say and file affidavits on that matter. So we have allowed her presentation to the next meeting. Right, that if there's no other person with any apology, then table the agenda with four legal opinions. And I believe the agenda was circulated.
Thank you, Chair. Just before yes, we go to the tabling of the submission, why do we stick with the apology?
In terms of the rule, it's absent that is noted. So we are receiving the apology, and he is in power. So he is serving in other committees. So it is a complicated matter in terms of the rule. So we will inquire on it. But he is not absent in power. Absent in power. He is waiting for proof of that. He is at another meeting. I would not. See any implication in terms of violation of rule. But obviously, we will explore the option of appointment of the acting of the co-acting chairs. That's something we will have to explore if that affects the running and business of the committee and if members would like. I don't know if it suffices that response. Thank you, thank you. Then we table that agenda before legal opinion to an item just presentation to the legal service office, legal advisor office. Can we move and support the agenda?
I will move the motion up. not confidence, but yes, to acknowledge and adopt the agenda as it is chair, and yes, we should move and shoot on the submission. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, first presenter, are you ready?
Thank you, Sir Professor. Good day to the members of the committee and colleagues. My name is Kian Isaac, and I will be presenting submission 1614. That's by Patrice Gabriel Marte. Our reference number is 47/2017, and the committee's reference number is PR16/14.
First one in the bundle.
Yes, Chair Gordon, the submission of the Martin makes 11 different proposals to amend the Constitution. I'm going to go through each one. It's quite a long opinion, so I'm going to try my best to keep it short and to just state the gist of the submission. So the first submission is that section 1 of the Constitution be amended to insert subsection 1-2. And the proposed amendment is that subsection 1-2 reads, supremacy of the Constitution is the supreme law of the Republic. law of conduct that is inconsistent with it is invalid and the obligation by it must be fulfilled. I point out that currently we have Section 2 of the Constitution which deals with the supremacy of the Constitution, and that section says the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and law of conduct inconsistent with it is invalid, and the obligation imposed by it must be fulfilled. It is my opinion or my view that what the submitter is proposing is already catered for in Section 2 of the Constitution. Further, the wording that he proposed is to follow this, that it's not very clear in the way he's drafted. And because Section 2 already caters for supremacy of the Constitution, this particular proposal is not necessary in terms of our current Constitution. Do you want me to go through all the submissions before the main?
Let's get one by one. So remember, yes, remember, the floor is open to your for consideration, remember? Going forward on this one, are we following the previous ruling of the committee where we're saying at a later stage you step up on it, right?
Yes. We note it.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Next submission.
Thank you. So the next proposed amendment is to Section 47A, Roman numeral 1, and the submitter proposes the following, the inserted. Ministers and their deputies should be excluded from voting concerning matters of parliament and should be allowed to vote on matters concerning their portfolios. Firstly, I point out that currently Section 47 of the Constitution deals with the requirements for membership of the National Assembly and circumstances where members may lose the membership. So this particular proposed amendment may not necessarily fit into Section 47, but dealing with the substance of the amendment, I point out that the ministers and deputy ministers, in terms of what the ministers in terms of Section 91, are appointed by the president, are members of the National Assembly, and for deputy ministers in terms of Section 93, they are appointed by the president, from also from members of the National Assembly. And the Constitution does allow for no more than two ministers and two deputy ministers to be appointed from outside the National Assembly. Now the point being is that, further I point out that in terms of the Constitution, ministers and deputy members, ministers who are members of the National Assembly, have the same voting rights as all other members. Section 53 of the Constitution provides as to how decisions of the National Assembly must be taken. And apart from the presiding officer, every member of the National Assembly has the same right to vote on any matter before the House. Now, just to tie up the point about how that the majority of ministers and deputy ministers are from the National Assembly, and the membership of the National Assembly is determined on a proportional basis. So, the submitter talks about excluding ministers and deputy ministers from matters of Parliament. Now, it is unclear what that actually means, because it could include quite a wide range of matters. Parliament's business is to pass legislation, to oversee the executive, and to hold into account. So the vast majority of matters could fall into this of matters of Parliament. And excluding ministers and deputy ministers will significantly affect the party that ministers and deputy ministers belong to. So a party who has the majority of ministers and deputy ministers will lose a number of votes because these ministers and deputy ministers will be excluded from voting on matters of Parliament. And in instances where a party is the ruling party and has a narrow majority, they will be hamstrung from passing legislation and making decisions before the House. So It also affects instances where there's special majorities in the constitution, so the ministers and deputy ministers are excluded from voting on certain issues. However, I do note that this is a policy consideration for the committee to make, but they must consider the merits of such an amendment and the effect it would have on voting on matters of parliament and how it would affect certain parties more than others. My submission on that matter.
Members, the merits of such a request and also the impact and consequence of such a decision should be granted.
Thank you so much. I think I agree with the President. Mr. Request are not easy to the future of the work of Parliament, especially in the past budget. Since then, the division of revenue, and I believe only the Minister of Finance is voting with the rest of the group. And even if we pass budget, especially in the past, where we need the majority, I do not think it was well accepted. It will jeopardize the work of Parliament instead of assisting to promote this issue. I think we should have put it here.
Yeah, Chair, I think I don't differ with the latter speaker, but it's to, of course, say we to note the questions, then we will be going to be the matter on that after we have noted that. I think that's good. Thank you, Chair.
All right,
we're
taking the next
submission.
Next submission is
deals with Section 48. The submission proposes that Section 48 be amended to reflect the following. He proposes the following. Any breach or inconsistency with the breaking of oath should have an amendment to terminate membership, giving extensive proof presented through a judicial court judgment of any concrete form. At present, Section 48 deals with members who have to take an oath when they join the assembly. And this particular section that deals with loss of membership of the National Assembly, Section 47.3, and it sets out how members may lose membership, firstly they will receive to be eligible, or if they absent without permission in terms of the rules, or lastly when they cease to be a member of the party they're nominating. So the Constitution does not provide for loss of membership where a member is found to have breached their oath of office. A member who has breached the oath of office may be referred to the Joint Commission on Ethics and members' interest to answer such allegations. However, the Code on Ethical Conduct and Disclosure of Members' Interest does not provide a sanction for termination of membership for an ethical breach. So currently, unless a member is not eligible in terms of the Constitution, only the member's party may terminate their membership to the National Assembly. Amending the Constitution for allow for termination of membership where a member breaches their oath of office is a policy consideration. However, if the committee accepts this proposal, they need to consider instances where what conduct would constitute a breach of office, and also they will have to have a process in place as to how a member of the National Assembly may be removed if they breach their oath. So this basically is a policy consideration for the committee to consider, but they need to set, if they accept the amendment, they need to also deal with the process and the procedural issues
getting
from such an amendment.
And where would it fit otherwise, actually, part of the position
would to
be talked
to? Well, currently, loss of membership is dealt with under Section 47. So we will have to either craft to take another step to say, or if the member breaches their oath, they will lose membership from the National Assembly.
All right, the
HM
members.
Chair,
yeah,
no, thank you, Chair. No, I want to agree with the presenter because
In that note, we must of course again note the submission we then take into consideration of the issues that we've got to be mentioned to be discussed to our leaders. Thank you.
So members will see
yes.
We come back with you on whether we want to strengthen the ethics section. Any further? The next one?
The next submission by Mr. Martin is dealing with Section 52. He proposes that Section 52.4 be amended to say that because it deals with the removal of the Speaker and Deputy Speaker, it says it should be voting for the resolution of the National Speaker or Deputy Speaker should be done through secret ballot. Currently, Section 52.4 states that the National Assembly may remove the Speaker or Deputy Speaker from office by resolution. A majority of the members of the National Assembly must be present when the resolution is adopted. So basically, it's proposing that when this vote takes place to remove the Speaker or Deputy Speaker, it might be done through a secret ballot. The issue of secret ballot has been before our Constitutional Court just recently in the matter of UGM versus Speaker of the National Assembly, where the court had to deal with the issue of whether a secret ballot was allowed for a motion to remove the president. And here the court held that, you know, the current rules of the National Assembly, it provides the Speaker with a discretion to determine whether voting should take place by secret ballot. And she has to consider various factors as to determine whether a secret ballot is appropriate in that circumstances of the current events before she decides to allow for such a voting mechanism. So amending the constitution as the submitter proposal will now mean that all resolutions to remove the speaker or deputy speaker will be done through speaker ballot. It will remove the discretion afforded to the speaker in terms of the rule. So now it will be a standard practice. Whenever the speaker or deputy speaker are removed, that vote will take place by secret ballot. So there's no issue of whether secret ballots are unconstitutional or not because the court has ruled on that. The question is, the rules currently allow the speaker that discretion, and the submitter proposes that we make it mandatory that it now be incorporated into the constitution and that all such removals take place with secret ballot. It is a policy decision for the committee to consider.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. My worry is if we follow this proposed amendment, taking away the discretion of the Speaker as provided by rules of Parliament, I think we will need to have genuine reasons for this. I think the Speaker would have committed a serious violation of the procedures or any other law of Parliament. That statement will take us to say we are removing that part of the discretion within the rules. But as far as I'm concerned, I do not think that we reach that stage to say discretion is provided by rules. We are checking them already. It might create another kind of worries when we debate this matter. So I believe that, and I know we were going to discuss it, but that's my submission. I think we need a strong motivation why we think we have to take away this kind of this.
Any further actions? It's a matter that talks to the rules, whether you move this thing to continue the constitution to strengthen that position, and I guess parties would have discussions and come back on the matter at a later stage before we conclude. All right.
The The next proposed amendment is to Section 55 of the Constitution. The submitter proposes that Section 55A be amended to provide as follows: that adequate remedial action is taken to the benefit of the credibility of the Parliament towards the citizens of the Republic, and overall international confidence in the country's stance on justice and conflict, to maintain order and decisive leadership to be upheld at all times. So currently, Section 55 of the Constitution deals with the powers of the National Assembly, and it provides that the National Assembly's powers are to legislate, to hold to account, and oversee the executive. My reading of this of the submitter's proposal is I'm not quite sure what he is proposing and what is the amendment he wants us to consider. So I was unclear as to what the submitter was proposing.
Members,
yeah.
I also think that the proposal is vague, and it's very difficult to interpret it as a field.
Let me see.
Yes,
I just
want to
jump.
Yes.
Maybe what I would like to ask the question is that after receiving this submission from this people, is the relevant section not making a sort of a follow-up in this regard, in trying maybe to unpack what the submitter might be meaning in this or her submission? Because even myself, when I get into reading this, I can't really get the truth. What is the relevant submitter meaning? So my humble question is wanting to know whether a follow-up of some kind is made in inquiring the exact meaning of the submission from the our legal advisor.
Normally, if members don't understand the submission on the part of the committee, you might request to interrogate the submitter if you feel that substantially the essence of the submission makes sense and might give rise to a constitutional amendment. So it's up to the members really, because we don't want secretary to interact with submitters and in a way try to influence them, or in one way or the other, you know, having to write for them or something. So it's up to the members really if you find any effort that justifies that we invite for oral presentation by the submit, otherwise it's a matter that is not understood. I don't know what's the action.
Yes. Thanks, Chair Malila.
Oh, yes.
Yes. No, Chair, I think it's proper to interrogate the submissions, not the submitter. Because we have to make sense of what they are saying so that we can be able to interpret them. If we can't be able to interpret, then that's that, and we have to let it go. It's up to them to present things that are very comprehensive. So interrogating submitters will be a problem. Mm-hmm.
I guess we're not calling for any for anybody to be submitter. All right. So we will not.
We
will note this part, this section as well, and Honorable Majaki.
Thank you. Just to take it back a bit, I want to know from the team as to whether we think what Mama is talking about is something that is viable. I mean, you actually also look at the range of work, many submissions you get, and the capacity as well, whether this is something that is but sometimes we don't just throw away everything we know from the world.
You want to ask, you want to reply, I don't know who wants to reply from the team.
Mm. Thank you, Chair. Shokosa, nothing stops the committee from interacting with the submitter or asking the staff to maybe ask the submitter to clarify his position. I think the aim of asking the public for submissions is to get their public input, and we want to make sure that we adequately engage with them. So it is for the committee to decide. If the committee feels that the submission makes zero sense and there's no point, then up to them. But the whole aim of asking for the constitutional review submission is to engage the public and allow them their say in the process.
Yeah,
follow-up.
Let's start with Majati's question.
In that case, I would actually then say that we can speak to Honorable Maila's position. I've got my answer.
Honorable Mutago?
Just as why is my initial asking question is because in most cases, I don't know when we as part of this committee, when advertising or calling for submissions are made, are we telling our people to also write in our languages? Because we must take into consideration that this Queen's language is not our language, isn't it? So people may try to, you know, to be smart, but wanting to say something which is very important, but because they are using Queen's language, may not be able to put it clearly. So in making a call for submission, are we encouraging our people also to write in all official languages, including the previously marginalized?
Can we ask one of the officials to give space to the members that's coming in? Honorable Chairman, want to say something?
I'm sorry. A particular submitter made quite a few submissions. In the past, we have had hearings or almost opportunities where a submitter could present to the committee. And wouldn't that also, in some instances, be a possibility to really understand what the submitter wants to propose?
Yeah, no, there is provision in the program in the budget for the committee to invite if they want to interrogate the submitter. Honorable Maila says that not every confusing submission that warrants us interrogating the submitter. That's what he said. And with regards to to the rest, we still have an opportunity when we decide the desirability finally, to when we conclude on each submission, perhaps to ask for further clarification from the submitter as the legal advisor is totally still within the ambit of the committee to have face to face interaction to the subject that's provided.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll reach that stage on this area of submission when we finalize on this submission. That's correct? That's fine?
Yeah.
Yes.
Sure. Next presentation.
submission. The next proposal is to section 64. The submitter proposes that section 64 of the Constitution to be amended as follows. Upon being sworn in by the Chief Justice or the delegated judge by the Chief Justice, the chairperson must relinquish their political membership until the tenure lapses to create balance in terms of showing non-partisanship towards opposition party members in Parliament. So basically, the submitter wants, the submitter proposes that the chairperson of the National Council of Provinces must relinquish political membership, and this is for the reasons of impartiality. I'm sure the submitter could also mean this to apply to the speaker, but here he just mentions the chairperson of the National Council of Provinces. In my research, chairperson and members, most parliaments don't require this of the presiding officers. I looked at a couple of constitutions, and most presiding officers retain their membership. The exception that I could find was the the practice of the House of Commons in the United Kingdom, which requires that the speaker must resign from their political party and remain separate from political issues even in retirement. So this is a practice that they have developed over the years. This is a policy consideration to the committee to make. The rules and the constitution does require the presiding officer to be impartial, but if the committee does agree with the committee that requiring the presiding officers to relinquish political membership, then this would be something to consider.
Ms. Isaac, you did look in Africa, right?
Yes, I did look in quite a few places. In India and Kenya, but it seems this is a debate that is quite current. Like, a lot of people are talking about the presiding officer's resigning, but then it's not something that has been accepted as a practice in most parliaments, with the exception that I could find out in the United Kingdom.
It raises serious interest in discussing it, but I would prefer to say, Chair, just notice, and if there are policy matters, we then deal with it through our committee. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, we noted for further discussions, but as we noted, Chair, I want to submit that the proposal also is in conflict with Section 47(3) of the Constitution. Maybe as we go on, we we'll then come to that. Because we are firing the person in the tunnel.
The next submission is regarding Section 83 of the Constitution. The submitter proposes that Section 83B be amended to say the following, that the President must be accountable for any infringement of the Constitution and be excluded from all duties of holding an office as a President of the Republic. As the number one citizen, the President must set a precedent over upholding the Constitution as it is the supreme law of the land, and the president and nobody is above the Constitution. So basically, the submitter is saying that the President must be held accountable and removed for any infringement of the Constitution. Currently, we do have procedures to remove the President for an infringement of the Constitution, and specifically Section 89(1)(b) provides that the National Assembly, by a resolution adopted by a supporting vote of at least two-thirds of its members, may remove the President from office on grounds of serious misconduct. So there is that present provision. What the committee must consider is that the submitter says that the President must be removed for any infringement of the Constitution. And any infringement could include both major infringement, which would result in a charge of serious misconduct, or minor and unintentional infringement. I mean, a lot of laws and conduct of the president is scrutinized by our court, and our courts have held that the president has acted in a way that violates the Constitution. For instance, in the case of pharmaceutical manufacturers, where the president signed the law into effect and the court found that he could not have done this, but he didn't act in bad faith. His intention was not to violate the Constitution. Obviously, he acted on advice and when he did this. So the consideration for the committee is that to remove the president for any violation of the Constitution would have far-reaching effects. So even if the president signs the law and later found to be unconstitutional, and for his conduct, for something where he acted in good faith is found to be unconstitutional, then he must be removed for such action. So the proposal has far-reaching consequences, but it is a policy consideration for the committee to consider.
Yeah, Chair, hey, the serious journalism need to discuss this one. Know why, Chair, I'm raising this, but of course we're going to note it. And when you pass a motion in the National Assembly to remove a president, you see, internationally, when we represent a lot of people, we say parliament, African parliament is composed of two houses, the National Assembly and the NSOP. But when you reach to this level, to this stage where you are going to remove a president, NSOP is not considered. And remember that those seats there in the NSOP are also composed out of the professional representation. Now the question is, will be the chair to the constitutional review committee. We need to look at this and maybe it gives us a window to also explore other countries how to debate with the two houses. In America, they are saying for them to remove a president, they must use the Senate situation. You remember when we established NCOP, we were usually attended the Senate House. What is his role now when it comes to this level? Removing a president of the country. But yeah, I'm just raising it here as a matter of concern, and we should look at it as a committee and look whether we cannot go and look at other countries, how do they manage this. But yes, let's note this section 83.
Any further reaction?
Chair, in addition to the former opposition that you see, because he talks about the window here, it's not only the issue on the president, there are a number of issues. Even when the budget is presented, not presented in the National Council of Provinces. So my proposal is that when we look at all these things, let's look at them not in isolation but holistically. The involvement of the National Council of Provinces in Parliament. But now the submission doesn't talk about that. It's specific, it's on the president. But I think we just note it for further discussion.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes,
while we sympathize with the NCOP, I think we need to make a submission on some of the issues that you're worried about. But to say that this section is the also in amendment needs to be submission is discussed about the president being made responsible for infringement of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. This is the example that I put in town problematic. In terms of lawmaking processes, president is the final term for something that would have actually taken too many offices. But anyway, we are just noting these concerns so that when we come back, we can put that into consideration. And also just to be conscious of the fact that we have clauses in the Constitution that are about the removal of the Constitution, and they should actually also guide us in terms of what the President might have to be removed from.
Further reactions? Isaac?
Chair, the next submission is regarding Section 84. The proposal is to Section 84E as follows. The appointment of the Constitution or the legislation requires should not solely be left to the President's prerogative as a leader to choose appointees. There should be a committee set including the Presidency and National Assembly members. So basically, the submission says that with the appointments which the President makes, either in terms of legislation or in the Constitution, should not be done by the President himself. There should be a committee with members of the Presidency and the National Assembly to make these appointments. Currently, with regard to the appointments that the President makes, Section 84.2e of the Constitution provides that the President is responsible for making an appointment, any appointment that the Constitution or legislation requires the President to make, other than head of the National Executive. So when the President acts in terms of Section 84.2e of the Constitution or any legislation, the Constitution and the legislation will set out who makes the recommendation for any such appointment and the process. So for instance, for the public protector, the National Assembly will make a recommendation to the President and the President must appoint. In such instances, the President does not have a discretion. He must endorse the decision of the appointing body that the Constitution or the legislation sets out. The President also has the power to make appointments as the head of the national executive. So as the President, as the head of government, he must be able to run government and decide that certain appointments need to be made for them to fulfill the mandate of his government. Now, the issue of setting up a committee with the Presidency and the National Assembly to make all such appointments, this is an issue that, in considering me from a legal point of view, this firstly will bring up issues of separation of powers. Mm-hmm. Can the National Assembly and the Presidency now sit together and make appointments? And secondly, this will breach the President or curtail the President's power to make appointments as head of government, to fulfill the mandate of his government. So these two considerations must be borne in mind in terms of this submission. And it will have, the proposed amendment is very broad and it deals with all sorts of appointments that the President makes. It doesn't differentiate where the President has a discretion and where he's merely acting on the recommendation of another body. And the current proposal undermines the separation of powers. It is not legally sound and it's my view that it should not be endorsed.
Thank you, Chair. Although, yes, as per most of our commission, we're going to move. I'd like to thank our legal advisors to the option of separation of powers to set all costs the appeal. And they are, in most of the legislation, like NDPP, constitutionally, Section 79, the South African Human Rights Commission, Public Protector, SABC Board, we know there are committees which are set, and therefore that should be upheld. Really. So the Constitution, I can say, I fully agree with you and we vote it.
Mine is a contradiction, not only in this answer, but I am starting to feel that we are piling up the necessary job for us to say we are not to reach everything. Can't we, when we see that there is a submission that is clearly unreasonable and inconsistent of the Constitution, and there is no way to modify it otherwise, we just cash it, and not to say we can't go into that unreasonable. So that those who are not here are the ones that are really relevant and need the submissions of our party. I can't take a clause or a submission that I see that really unreasonable to my caucus to discuss. The first thing they will say, but when, what do you think about this? What do you bring it to us? So I'm saying maybe some of the proposals that really does not require that status of further consideration. Let's just crush it and move on with others. Thank you.
Chairperson, I agree with
my learned friend and say the previous submission out of the window and this one out of the window. We are not going to consider the future. They are just in conflict with the constitution.
Yeah, Chair, you say we should not operate like this, like reactionary.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot be reactionary in dealing with these issues, Chair. We have agreed with the principle to say we don't. Therefore, if we decide that we must have another methodology of approaching this, let's arrange such an item and discuss. Because I understand that when we arrive at the determination that we must not, we deliberated much, and that deliberation must not undermine that deliberation. In that note, Chair, I'm not taking the notion that our honourable members are raising for granted. It is best met as this, but let us consider it next time. For now, let's carry on with the principles as agreed until such time that we meet and replenish again the another mode of governance. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, before you order.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I want to support the colleague there because, you know, if we on one day feel in terms of merits, we just want to shoot something down. The processing of these matters is quite important. We must, you know, consider each submitter's, presentation in the same fashion. We agreed previously on a principled approach. We take the presentations and then later we will consider it. We can even do it quite quickly when we consider it, but I think it's fair to all the submitters that we use the same process because they might argue now that we are using different methodologies on different days, and I think it won't spell well for this commission to function. Thank you.
No further action? All right. I think the chair from SAPS. That's what I was going to say, that we are considering the report as we react to them as part of the business of the committee to consider the submission in the legal opinion. Then at a later stage, we will table the submission, hopefully parties will be ready. So there is no transient ready, to really throw this one out of the committee. Let's take the next one. Ms. Isaac, you still have some more?
Yes, I'm still there's quite a few more.
It made you earn your money, right? This
yes.
Submitter, right?
The next section is section 89.1, and the proposal is as follows. The National Assembly, by a resolution adopted with a vote that is automatically unanimous, may remove the President from office on the grounds that all or any of the stipulated grounds of impeachment are transferred. And then the second point is the National Assembly cannot override the constitutional breach of the President on the ground of cadreship that is inconsistent with upholding the Constitution. So firstly, the removal of the President must be on a unanimous vote, and secondly, he uses the term cadreship. This must not be a consideration when removing the President. My first point is that the submitter uses the word unanimous, and unanimous means in complete agreement. Therefore, if the President is to be removed according to this submission, if this is accepted, then it would require all the members of the National Assembly to vote in favor of the removal of the President for a Section 89 motion to carry. This threshold is far higher than the current one, which is a vote of two-thirds of the members of the National Assembly. So if in considering this amendment, the practicality and the effect of this amendment must be considered in that it will be extremely difficult to remove the President if by a unanimous vote, while currently a two-thirds majority is something that is attainable and it is a threshold that was set out to much consideration in the Constitution. The second issue is that cadreship or political allegiance should not be used as a consideration when removing the President. My view is that removal of the President does entail political considerations, and the submitter does not clearly articulate how you curtail a member from exercising political considerations when they vote. It will be extremely difficult to now prevent members from doing so. The Constitution sets the grounds of removal of the president. They must apply their mind rationally to those grounds. But to say that, to stipulate in the Constitution that they cannot use political considerations will be difficult in a political environment. And the committee doesn't make clear as to how this must be done.
Member?
No, thanks, Chair. This submission is almost similar to seeing the President handling the committee. Although we still have to consider it, but I think it makes things even more difficult. Because, I mean, how do you become unanimous in a political setup?
So we would like for further consideration. Yes, Honorable Councillor Animacha.
Yeah.
Next one.
Thank you, Chair. The next submission is Section 91. The submitter proposes in Section 91A to read as follows. A curb of any determinable number of ministers and their deputies should be exercised to avoid a bloated number of cabinet ministers and their deputies, as that has huge financial ramifications for the taxpayers' money. So basically, the submitter wants Section 91A to be amended to have a limit on the number of ministers and deputy ministers that may be appointed by the president. Currently, there is no such limit. The president may choose to appoint members to his cabinet as he feels that he is adequate to discharge the duty of government. However, looking at international practice, I do note that the Constitution of India does have a limit on the number of ministers that may be appointed. It states that no more than 15% of the Lok Sabha may be appointed by the Prime Minister to his cabinet. And in the United Kingdom, the House of the British Prime Minister also has a limit. There's an act called the Ministerial and Other Salaries Act, which sets the limit as to the number of cabinet ministers. And in terms of the number of paid cabinet ministers, in the UK, there may be no more than 21 cabinet ministers. So the submission is to set a limit on the appointment of cabinet is a policy consideration for the members and the committee to consider.
Okay.
The last one for this question is Section 96. The submitter proposes Section 96B to read as follows. The minister and deputy ministers must declare their business interests before appointment to office and also be subjected to lifestyle audits to determine if privileged information of their office is being used to unlawfully amass wealth through unscrupulous insider trading funds. Currently, the Constitution does provide for the ethical duties of members of cabinet. Section 96 sets out that there needs to be a code and legislation needs to be enacted, and this was done in terms of the Members Executive Members Act, and there is a Members Executive Code which requires cabinet members and deputy ministers to declare their financial interests. Also, the ministers and deputy ministers who are members of the National Assembly are also subjected to the Ethics Code of the National Assembly, of Parliament, and they are also required to declare in terms of that. Currently, in terms of the Executive Ethics Code, the members of cabinet and deputy ministers must disclose their financial interests to the Secretary of Cabinet within 60 days of assuming office or when they become aware of this financial interest, and then thereafter they must do so annually. So the issue is for consideration is whether the ministers and the deputy ministers must declare prior to taking office. And the consideration is the practicality of this. It is practical to require this to be done. Considering how ministers and deputy ministers' appointment, is there sufficient time for them to be able to get their financial interest in order to make the necessary disclosures. Secondly, the other proposal is that of requiring ministers and deputy ministers to be subjected to a lifestyle audit. This requires further scrutiny, and whether it is proper for such a clause to be in the Constitution or should it be in the Executive Ethics Code. And if this is considered in the Ethics Code, then there needs to be a process within place as to when a minister will be subjected to a lifestyle audit. So there's a lot of process and analysis of consideration in such an amendment, and as to whether it is proper for it to be in the Constitution. Those are my submissions.
Good afternoon, Chair and honourable members and colleagues. My name is Fatima Ibrahim, and I'm dealing with submission CR16/18, Legal Services Reference 117 of 2017, and it's the submission by Ms. Pumutso Nesivani. Chair, Ms. Nesivani's submission requests for the committee to look at two particular issues with multiple sub-issues under those issues. The first relates to sections 83 to 102 of the Constitution, which deals with the President and the National Executive, and then she also asks the committee to apply its mind to certain sections in the Bill of Rights. I'll deal with each of these separately, and I suppose that we take the way my colleague Ms. Isaac said, that we dispense with each issue as I finish that particular issue, because mine is also quite long. Thank you. The first one deals with the term of office of President. The submission states that the President should not hold office for more than two terms in fear of creating a dictator-run state. This concern is covered by Section 88(2), which already provides that no person may hold office as president for more than two terms. So there's no amendment that's required here.
Don't you remember?
I seem to have lost now. Well, maybe I'm giving you a different thing.
We have a bad long legal opinion. All right. Are you noting that one, members?
Chair, the next one deals with the issue of conflict of interest. The submission states that the president shouldn't be associated with anyone with shares to a privately owned company. So I see that the concern presumably speaks to the issue of conflict of interest. The submitter hasn't phrased it in that sense. But Section 96 of the Constitution, as Sir Anne has already explained, already deals with conflict of interest. And it certainly provides that there must be a code of ethics prescribed by national legislation. We know that this finds expression in the Executive Code of Ethics, which was promulgated in terms of the Executive Members Act. Section 69 then also contains specific prohibitions that I'm sure the members are familiar with, so I won't go into detail. But Section 96 does not contain a blanket prohibition as proposed by Ms. Nesivani, which prevents the president from being associated with any person who has shares in a privately owned company. In my view, the proposal is impractical, and it creates a threshold that in reality would be impossible to meet. The president, like any other citizen, will have associations or relations with private companies whether these arise because of the president acting as the consumer of goods or services in his or her personal capacity, or because of the president interacting with persons for official business where such persons now may have shares in private companies. In my view, the current wording of Section 69 is crafted in such a way as to not completely prohibit the president from being associated with persons who have interest in private companies, except to the extent that such association creates a possible conflict of interest. In my view, this is more than sufficient. Thank you. Proceed. Now, Chair, last week I know the members weren't too happy that we made comparison to the U.S. Constitution, but that submission, like this one, is the submitter themselves that are using the U.S. Constitution. So from here on onwards, what the submitter appears to have done is just to copy the U.S. Constitution verbatim, but I'll respond. So on the first point, the submitter states that the president shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators president concur. And he shall nominate by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to appoint ambassadors and other public ministers. So there's two parts, and I'll deal with each separately. As I said, it appears to be drawn from Article 2, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution. So international agreements is what we refer to as treaties in our law, and that's dealt with in Section 213 of the Constitution. And in terms of this section, all international agreements must be negotiated and signed by the national executive, provided that such agreements will only be binding on the Republic after it has been approved by resolution in both the NA and the NCOP. So the main distinguishing feature between the U.S. Constitution and our constitution is that the former requires a two-thirds majority of the Senate present, whereas the latter requires a simple majority of the National Assembly. Whether the threshold needs to be increased, therefore, is a matter of policy. Okay, then the second issue relates to the appointment of ministers and ambassadors. As my colleague Ms. Isaacs explained, the president appoints any number of ministers from the National Assembly and a maximum of two ministers from outside the National Assembly. Similarly, the president also has the prerogative in terms of Section 84.2.1 to appoint ambassadors. The appointment of ministers and ambassadors is therefore, unlike in the U.S., not dependent on consent from the National Assembly. It is a prerogative that resides squarely with the president. Whether a consent requirement must include it to limit the president's powers, as is the case in the U.S., is a question for policy consideration. Chair, the next one, Ms. Netsivani proposes that the president, vice president, which in our case would be a deputy president, and public officers be removed from office if impeached and convicted of treason, bribery, or other high crimes or misdemeanor. So this proposal, like last week's one, is based on the U.S. Constitution, and I think I explained in sufficient detail the U.S. impeachment process last week, so I'm not going to go into that again. It is contained in the opinion. We, of course, have Section 89, which deals with the removal of the president. These grounds of treason, bribery, high crimes, or misdemeanors, which the U.S. Constitution uses, I think is already adequately covered where we speak of serious violation of the Constitution or the law, serious misconduct, or inability to perform the functions of office. I think it can be read into those broad grounds. The difference is that our Section 89 does not deal with the removal of the Deputy President, and whether the Deputy President should be included in that Section 89 provision is a matter for policy consideration. Then, furthermore, the U.S. version also refers to public officers, and I presume that these would mean officers that are appointed by the president, such as members of the judiciary, heads of state institutions supporting direct democracy, and the Director of Public Prosecution. So the removal of these persons are dealt with in separate sections, and they do not form part of Section 89. So our constitution in various other sections deals with these officials or in other pieces of legislation. By way of example, the removal of judges is dealt with in Section 177. The removal of the National Director of Public Prosecution is dealt with in the National Prosecuting Authority Act. And the removal of heads of state institutions supporting democracy, these are Chapter 9 bodies, that finds expression in Section 194. Now, in all of these removals, the NA does indeed have a role to play in that removal process. So the question of whether it should be incorporated under 189, which is specifically dealing with the president, is a matter for policy consideration, but personally, Chair, I don't think it's necessary because it is adequately dealt with elsewhere in the Constitution. Okay. The next part of the submission deals with various rights in the Bill of Rights. Unfortunately, the submitter merely said that the committee should look at particular rights. And again, those rights seem to be have been saved based on other constitutions and not our own, but I'll go through each of them. The first is a right to an adequate standard of living, including adequate food, clothing, and housing. Our constitution doesn't have a provision that speaks directly to an adequate standard of living. However, we do protect the right to sufficient food and water, as well as access to adequate housing. Altogether, these would form part of the right to an adequate standard of living. That is guaranteed, but in different, the components are dealt with separately. These rights are not absolute, and the state must take reasonable legislative and other measures within available resources to achieve progressive realization. There is no right to adequate clothing contained in our constitution. However, the right is contained in Article 11 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. This is a multilateral treaty adopted by the United Nations, and South Africa ratified this treaty in 2015. The treaty does indeed create legal obligations on South Africa. I can't find any other constitution that deals specifically with the right to clothing. However, Chair, in my view, the right to clothing is in fact implicit in the right to dignity, which is contained in Section 10. And in fact, in the landmark Voortboom judgment by the Constitutional Court, which dealt with housing, the court there did state that all rights in our Bill of Rights are interrelated and mutually supporting. There can be no doubt that human dignity, freedom, and equality, the very foundational values of our society, are denied to those who don't have food, clothing, or shelter. So in my view, all of the rights proposed by the submitter are already adequately dealt with.
Yeah, the ratifications are legal obligations, so we might look at it at a later stage what the implications mean if in that continent we are obliged to talk to Kubari Kutiola. So, any reaction?
Yeah, not
but Chair, why do we have to react because we know and then there's going to be a discussion later? So it's not no value.
We are in committee on our Muta Shopping and we are considering the legal opinion based on the submission that you made.
Yeah.
Just to find rationality in dealing with the aspect. But we are in business, serious business of consideration. We should not give the perception that this is just buying passing time. It's like when you consider the bill, it takes almost 6 months to consider a bill, looking into every aspect. So this is serious business, honestly speaking.
Okay.
Yeah, Chair, of course I will move that we note it, of course, consider the publishing of the bill of rights. Just to add perspective on it, Chair. You see, we're having a challenge with the food security issues. We can't regulate the prices and so on, we're having challenges. So Yeah, I'm just saying the members, we need to look at it and decide if a caucus could be discussed. That's not what the chair did.
Do you have a reaction?
Yes,
chair,
no.
Yes,
chair. Well, I'm persuaded to say we note. I have now Chair, on this one, in as much as we've been considering in our caucus, but I feel that we should also put into the constitution that it really meets our state of existence. Because once you speak of other things, protein, food, read our constitution gives us that kind of a state that is not a developmental as NPP says, but clearly a welfare state and forces social corruption.
Thank you. The next one?
The head, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Also, let's just try to be consistent. Because now comes the right to close it. But you know, the language that we use after now is social economic rights. So we need to look at it from that perspective and the kinds of provisions that actually mean the South Africans to manage to realize such rights.
Okay,
Chairperson, then moving on, the next part of the submission says that there must be a right to receive adequate health care free at any point of use. Section 27.1a already guarantees everyone the right to have access to health care services, including reproductive health care. And Section 27.3 states that no one may be refused emergency medical treatment. However, the right to access health care services is limited. The state must take reasonable legislative and other measures within its available resources to achieve a progressive realization of this right. I'm sure members are familiar with the case of Subramani versus the Minister of the Health, versus Minister of Health, rather, where Mr. Subramani was suffered from chronic renal failure and was refused access to dialysis. Here, the court found that the state was not in breach of its duty to provide adequate health care because it had to be done within available resources. This issue of it being free at point of use thus must be considered in regard to the fact that our constitution takes cognizance of the fact that the state may not immediately be able to provide everybody with something for free. However, on the same point, there is in the pipeline the National Health Insurance Scheme, which is indeed designed to ensure that all citizens have a right to access comprehensive health care free of charge at the point of use at accredited health facilities. So this discussion is indeed currently happening. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Chair, while considering that this discussion is still happening, especially on the National Health Policy, the issue is, Chair, as a committee, we should check whether it is visible or practical that the National Health Care Policy complies with the legislative constraints on the constitution. I'm just raising it. And there is no chance that we will have a very good meeting. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Next one.
Chair, the next one. The submitted states that there must be a right to work in an occupation freely entered into in a safe environment. Section 22 of the Constitution guarantees every citizen the right to choose their trade, occupation, or profession freely. Section 24 further grants everyone the right to an environment that is not harmful to their health or well-being. And that environment would, of course, include your working environment. Therefore, it's already adequately covered, and it's not clear what further amendment the submitter seeks.
Hopefully we applied our minds.
We have applied our minds because already we have provisions. There's absolutely no need for us to change the endangerment.
Chair, the next one, the right of workers to resort to collective action, including the right to strike. Section 23 of the Constitution contains, in fact, far more substantial protection of labour rights than what the submitted states in that one line. These include, amongst others, the right of workers to form and join a trade union and to strike. Therefore, in my view, no further amendments are necessary.
I'm sure you applied your mind.
So the next one, Chair, the submitter states that the rights of certain groups within society shall be given special regard, in particular the rights of children, older people and people with disabilities. Children's rights are really guaranteed. There's a standalone section 28 that deals with the rights of children, and it guarantees children the right, amongst others, to basic nutrition, shelter, protection from maltreatment, abuse and neglect, and family or parental or appropriate alternative care. There is, however, no standalone clauses in the Constitution dealing with older people or people with disabilities. However, these persons are eligible to enjoy all rights in the Bill of Rights. It would apply equally to them, the rights relating to housing, health, education, or any of the other rights. But furthermore, our Section 9(3) also states that the state may not unfairly discriminate directly or indirectly against anyone on the grounds of age or disability. So that right, to me, seems to encompass the concern that we don't specifically deal with older people or people with disabilities. However, whether the committee feels that those categories of people need to be dealt with in separate provisions is an issue for policy consideration, but I am of the view that it is already covered, Jim. Chair, that is also my side. Unfortunately, the submitter, when it came to the rights, didn't indicate what it is the problem was. She simply stated certain rights, and as I've shown, all of those rights are in fact covered in some form or another. If she is indeed referring to the fact that the rights are limited, dependent on the resources, that is something that the committee can consider. But cognizance must be taken that practically, if rights were to be absolute and not dependent on economic resources, then indeed we will create a welfare state, and I think it would be impossible then for the state to meet all its obligations given the current social and financial restraints. Thank you.
We must note that concluding remark, very good.
No, I'm okay, the Chair.
All right. Presenter.
Good afternoon, Chair and two honorable members. My name is Natum Jerman, and my presentation is on submission number, for reference, legal services reference number 123 of 2017, and the committee reference CR 1676. Chair, the first thing submitting to the committee for review and amendment is Advocate Makabe, and he requests the committee to consider reviewing and amending Section 179 and 188 of the Constitution. Section 179 is the one that we spoke to in our last meeting, Chair, that refers to the National Prosecuting Authority, and Section 188 refers to or provides for the Auditor General. Advocate Makabe the manner in which the National Prosecuting Authority Director, or the NPPT, is appointed is unconstitutional, and therefore Section 179 must be of the Constitution must be reviewed and amended to allow for public advertisement of the post of the National Director of Public Prosecutions when it becomes vacant, and that all members of the public must be allowed to apply for that post, and that suitable candidates must contest for it, and they must have to choose in that regard, without it being appointed directly by the president is currently present. He also says that the manner in which the judges' interviews are conducted, which is in public, in full view of everyone, should also be adopted, or the constitution must be changed to provide for similar arrangements when the position of the NAFA director for the position is being filled. He goes on, Chair, to say that the fact that the Minister of Justice exercises final responsibility over the constitutional authority weakens the independence and impartiality of the prosecution authority. And in our view, Chair, or in our analysis of the applicable legislative framework and advice to the committee,
we are of the view that the national director from all the prosecution's authority falls within the realm of the executive and not the judiciary. And that in itself does not indicate impartiality or lack of independence. This was decided in the certification case in 1996, as we advise in our last decision. The court in this regard mentioned that the prosecuting authority is not part of the judiciary, and it explains that the fact that the president appoints the NGPP does not necessarily pose challenges for its independence. That is our submission in regard to this submission, Chair. As it regards to Section 188, here, with the one relating to the Auditor General, Chair, I will ask you guidance if you want me to give them a moment to comment before I move on to the part relating to the Auditor General.
Sure.
Thank you, Chair. The one relating to the Auditor General, the submitter is of the view that Section 188 of the Constitution, which establishes and gives powers to the Auditor General, does not provide for a duty of on the AG to submit to the South African Police Services or the National Prosecuting Authority for them to investigate and with a view to prosecute those who are found to have done wrong in the course of the AG. Chair, we have analyzed the law applicable here. And our view, Chair, is that the AG reports are submitted to Parliament for Parliament to exercise its oversight functions as obligated by the Constitution to follow on all of the recommendations that are set out in those reports by the Auditor General. And that there is no need, and these are also done publicly, and that there is no need to amend the Constitution, or at least there is no justified basis in law to go and amend the Constitution to provide for the AG to submit its reports to the SAPS as well as the NPA. And that is our view on this question. Thank you.
Members,
what
I said
as
a request, I
think
right, noted. Thanks, Nati. So because I see that you are considering, you are not deferring. I was worried earlier about deferring.
Greetings to the members. Thank you, Chairperson. Once again, I get the last word. Chairperson, perhaps with your permission, if I can just quickly touch on the question that was raised about compulsion of submission. I think where we are not clear and where the resources are permitting us as legal advisors or the legal services offices, we are enabled or can contact the submitter and find clarity on their issues where we are not clear in order to enable us also to give a thorough, considered opinion. Like in the instance of my one, because the details were there and I could and I was able to get through to the person that wrote them in order to get further clarity. So it's not an issue beforehand once we have received the submission for the request of the legal opinion that if our resources are allowing that we consult them, but then as also indicated, the committee can at any time also call during the deliberations for the people that may want to come and elaborate on their submission. Thank you, Chair, on that. My specific one,
Honourable Dr. Mark,
I think we have deliberated on this and we concluded that whatever is brought in, if it's not clear, it's satisfied. And I think it's about issues of control. Maybe telling a thinking, maybe not product group, allowing me to go and construct it in a way that maybe you might have to engage somebody. But then you came to, I think it was your conclusion that maybe we should actually just maybe so if we can manage to submit something that can actually easily be understood.
All right.
Chairperson. Thank you, Honourable Member. My specific one is a proposal that we look into Section 196, 2 and 4 of the Constitution. And those specific provisions basically deal with the Public Service Commission. With the permission of the Chairperson, if I may read subsection 2, it basically reads that the Commission is independent and must be impartial and must exercise its powers and perform its functions without fear, favor, or prejudice in the interest of the maintenance of effective and efficient public administration and a high standard of professional ethics in the public service. The Commission must be regulated by national legislation. I will jump straight to subsection 4 because there already exists national legislation that guides how the Public Service Commission should function and what it is all about. Sub 4, which the submitter has consent, also in respect of subsection paragraph D and F, and are the only ones I'm going to read. Sub 4D reads, the powers and functions of the Commission are to give directions aimed at ensuring that personal procedures relating to recruitment, transfers, promotions, and dismissals comply with the values and principles set out in Section 195. And F, the powers and functions of the Commission are either of its own accord or on receipt of any complaint to investigate and evaluate the application of personnel and publication administration practices and to report to the relevant executive authority and legislature. Sub 2, to investigate grievances of employees in the public service concerning official acts or omissions and recommend appropriate remedies. Those are the main relevant sections that the submitter, in this case, Ms. Tizani, spoke to and wanted the committee to take a consideration whether it cannot be reviewed. She's basically, with the first point, worried that there is no independence of the Public Service Commission, despite the provisions ensuring that it must be an independent commission. One of the questions she raised when I spoke to her was that because it allows the department to be involved in the appointment of their staff, that is where most of her issues arose, other than looking into how the independence of the commission is actually achieved. Furthermore, she's then saying the fact that the Constitution is enabling the Public Service Commission to be involved in the processes of recruiting and appointing within the public service sector, it takes away the independence, and it is also not supposed to be so, because in terms of the other existing legislation, like your Labor Relations Act, the Public Service Act, that is already sufficiently dealt with. Now, in scrutinizing the submission completely and looking at the relevant legislation, it was very clear that from the submitter's perspective, she has misconstrued the provision. She has, in other words, understood them, giving them the interpretation that they do not deserve and the interpretation that they do not actually, when you speak to them and they are being applied, does not come to their conclusion. Thus, in our view and in trying to direct how the committee should handle this submission, we are basically saying from what he has indicated, it's not an issue of a subsidiary principle, where we are saying there is nothing wrong with the Constitution, but perhaps there is problem that will arise from the relevant legislation that Parliament has enacted. That also is not the case, because legislation and the functions of this commission is more like an advisory and investigative role into all those processes that have been explained. But it does not make the Public Service Commission to be part of the processes. For example, the Public Service Commission does not form part of the appointment processes or the recruitment processes when they take place in the department. It does not. But where it comes in is where should there be a concern or a dispute or a claim coming from anyone, whether a respective employee or an employee within the public sector, then they will decide as to whether do I go to CCMA to lay my complaint or do I go to the PSC, the Public Service Commission. But the way the relevant legislation and the Constitution itself is crafted it's basically opening up space to a choice for you who is aggrieved as to where you go to once you need to find recourse. So as I indicated, in this instance, it was very clear. It was an absurd interpretation of the relevant provision, and therefore, because it's misconstruction, there's probably and possibly nothing that is wrong with the provision in the Constitution that she has referred to, as well as there's nothing lacking in the relevant legislation that speaks further on what the Section 196 in relation to the Public Service Commission is providing. In that short submission, then, we are saying from our perspective, there is absolutely no necessity that the committee look further into this because it was a point of misconstruction, the provision as it stands. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable members?
No,
thank you. Yes,
no
further thank you. Legal advisors, we thank you for your presentation. That helped us to find some legal positions and advice. We thank the Parliamentary Legal Service for this work. We hope to see you again, or those that are still to bring more next week. Honorable members, that was the last item on the agenda. We also thank you. No, honorable members, we really thank you for making time. It's quite an awkward time that we sit. We thank you for honoring your decision. Let's find any slot you'll commit to. So we try by all means. We continue to sit on Thursday up until we close this chat. Thank you, and the meeting stays adjourned.
Yeah.